You're listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio. This is Slave Revolt Radio on 104.1 on your dial. We're going to begin with some information about Standing Rock. Police from 5 states have escalated the violence, shot horses to clear 1851 treaty camp.
This week, there was a raid on the camp at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Over 300 police officers in riot gear showed up with 8 ATVs, 5 armored vehicles, 2 helicopters, and numerous military-grade Humvees north of the newly formed frontline camp, which is just east of Highway 1806. The 1851 treaty camp was set up this past Saturday directly in the path of the Dakota Access Pipeline on land recently purchased by DAPL. The camp is a reclamation of unceded Dakota territory, affirmed as part of the Standing Rock Reservation in the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, and was violently cleared. Both blockades established this past weekend to enable that occupation were also cleared. In addition to pepper spray and percussion grenades, shotguns were fired into the crowd with less lethal ammunition, and a sound cannon was used. At least one person was tased, and the barbed hook lodged in his face, just outside his eye. Another was hit in the face by a rubber bullet. A prayer circle of elders, including several women, was interrupted, and all were arrested for standing peacefully on the public road. A teepee was erected in the road and was recklessly dismantled, despite promises from law enforcement that they would merely mark the teepee with a yellow ribbon and ask its owners to retrieve it. A group of water protectors was also dragged out of a ceremony in a sweat lodge erected in the path of the pipeline, wearing minimal clothing, thrown to the ground, and arrested. A member of the International Indigenous Youth Council that had her wrist broken during a mass arrest on October 22nd was hurt again after an officer gripped her visibly injured wrist and twisted it during an attempted arrest. At least 6 other members of the Youth Council verified they had been maced up to 5 times and were also shot and hit with beanbags. In addition to being assaulted, an altar item and sacrifice staff was wrenched from the hands of an IIYC member by police. Several other sacred items were reported stolen, including a sacred tobacco pipe. 2 medics giving aid at frontline were hit with batons and thrown off the car they were sitting on. Then police grabbed another medic who was driving the car out of the driver's side while it was still in motion. Another water protector had to jump into the car to stop it from hitting other people. Members of the Horse Nation herded around 100 buffalo from the west and southwest of the Cannonball Ranch onto the DAPL easement. One rider was reportedly hit with up to 4 rubber bullets. His horse was reported to be hit in the legs by live rounds. Another horse was shot and did not survive. A confirmed DAPL private security guard was spotted among the protectors with an automatic rifle heading towards camp. Water protectors acted swiftly to stop the man who was attempting to flee the scene in his pickup. One protector stopped the assailant's vehicle with their own, before the security guard fled to nearby waters, weapon in hand. Bureau of Indian Affairs police arrived on scene and apprehended him. Three water protectors locked themselves to a truck in the middle of the road and surrounded it with large logs. After several hours of standoff, the police advanced in a sweep line and moved people approximately 1 mile back down the highway towards the main encampment on the Cannonball River. Water protectors then retreated to the bridge over Highway 1806 and erected a large burning blockade that the police were unable to cross. Law enforcement from at least five states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wyoming, Nebraska, were present today through EMAC, the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. This law was passed by the Bill Clinton administration and allows states to share law enforcement forces during emergencies. It is intended for natural disasters and has only been used twice for protests. Once in the summer of 2015 during the demonstrations in Baltimore, and here on the Standing Rock Reservation. Over 100 were arrested today in total. Candy Mossett, Indigenous Environmental Network, stated, "I went to the front line in prayer for protection of the Missouri River and found myself in what I can only describe as a war zone. I was sprayed in the face with pepper spray. The guy next to me was shot by something that didn't break the skin but appeared to have broken the ribs. And another guy beside me was randomly snatched violently by police, shoving me into the officers who held me off with batons, then tried to grab me. I'm still in shock and keep waiting to wake from what's surely a nightmare. Though this is my reality as a Native woman in 2016 trying to defend the sacred." LaDonna Brave Bull Allard of Sacred Stone Camp says, "My people stand for the water and they attack us. My people stand up for the graves of our people and they attack us. My people stand up for our sacred places and they attack us. My people pray and they don't stop, dragging us from our prayer and throw us in the dirt. I know this is America. This is the history of my people. America has always walked through the blood of my people. How can we stand in the face of violence? Because I was born to this land, because the roots grow out of my feet, because I love this land and I honor the water. Have we not learned from history? I pray for each of the people who stand up. We cannot live like this anymore. It has to stop. My grandchildren have a right to live. The world has a right to live. The water, the lifeblood of the world, has a right to live." Mini Wakoni, Water of Life. "Pray for the water. Pray for the people. Stop Dakota Access, killer of the world." Erin Wise of the International Indigenous Youth Council stated, "Today, more than half of our youth council were attacked, injured, or arrested. In addition to our brothers and sisters being hurt and incarcerated, we saw police steal our sacred staff. I have no words for what happened to any of us today. They are trying to again rewrite our narrative, and we simply will not allow it. Our youth are watching and remember the faces of the officers that assaulted them. They pray for them."
Santi, what is a sacred staff?
What is a sacred staff?
What is he talking about?
He was referring to the tobacco pipe.
Okay. Well, thank you. You got some more on this, don't you?
There is another update on Standing Rock. The United Nations sent a delegate to Standing Rock on Saturday, yesterday, and the delegate from the United Nations, Grand Chief Edward John, went to gather information on human rights violations resulting from pipeline construction. And he is a member of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And his visit is within his official capacity to observe the continued impacts of the Dakota Access Pipeline construction, such as threats to water, treaty rights, and sacred areas. His visit is also to collect testimonies on the escalating levels of repression, violence, and intimidation against tribal members and their supporters by state law enforcement, private security, and the National Guard, which have been widely reported on social and other media. Roberto Borrero, representing the International Indian Treaty Council, will accompany him, or did accompany him, I should say, as a human rights observer. And IITC board member William Means of the Oglala Lakota Nation is already on site. So that is a really important update for these egregious human rights violations to be documented and exposed, and also important for the United Nations to intervene to demonstrate that this goes beyond like a state violation, this is beyond like a federal violation, that this is like an international violation of human rights. And this is a violent, continual violence of settler colonialism in the form of resource extraction that needs to be stopped. It needs to be stopped. It needs to be challenged. And really, really big step that the United Nations is going to be documenting these human rights violations.
Well, what do you think needs to happen now in terms of, you know, people in America? What can we do to assist? You know, this struggle is not simply about Indians. This struggle is about water and our ability to drink clean water. Well, what do you think is, you know, our next step here? What do you think should happen?
Well, there was a call out released from the Standing Rock encampment on Friday, Thursday night, Friday during the day, and this person who released the call out was on the front lines during the raid and announced that people in their own territories need to be organizing against resource extraction and like ecological degradation, and that is happening everywhere. It's not only happening at this one geographical place. So
where?
It's not just happening at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Environmental racism in particular is very insidious and pervasive, and the pipeline was actually rerouted as a result of white residents in North Dakota choosing, you know, not to have it in their own backyard, like this whole NIMBY argument. And so what ended up happening is that the pipeline was rerouted into indigenous territory. And I think that there are plenty of examples of environmental racism everywhere. You know, Flint, Michigan is a good example too of this same dilemma of this is a resource that we need to survive. So, like, yes, it's not just about colonial violence. It's also about basic resources that we all need to survive, but it's really important for us to make those intersections and, most importantly, to get organized and get involved locally in some form of support. There are supply lists available online where you can send a care package to Standing Rock so people can camp out for the winter. And there are multiple Facebook pages for the Standing Rock encampment that have these supply lists, and so care packages, sending like supplies for the winter is something to do. But also there's demonstrations and protests happening across the country too, and it's really important for this to not be isolated in one place. It needs to be spread out.
Seems to me that there is some confusion on the part of those people that said, well, not in our backyard, because in fact when you spoil the water that affects everyone, not just Native Americans. And that's, I think, needs to be driven home here, that it is not, this is not only a matter of environmental racism. This is not only a matter of the mistreatment of these Indians, but this is something, if they spoil the water, it's going to affect millions of people. That's the point.
And the point too is, I agree with you, and also that pipelines rupture on almost a weekly basis in the United States. Like, that pipelines rupture constantly. Like, that is a guarantee that at some point there will be some issue that is out of the control of the pipeline company, whether it's like a natural disaster, you know, like an earthquake or something like that. But the point is that pipelines are not secure, and especially in close proximity to a resource that you need to survive. Like, that is inseparable from any human or biotic community, is water.
Okay, we're going to move it on now to Here's What I'll Do the Day After the Election by Bernie Sanders. And I think this is interesting and something that we want to discuss here now. He says, I am currently working as hard as I can to see that Donald Trump is defeated, that Hillary Clinton is elected president, and that the Democrats gain control of the U.S. House and Senate. Well, okay, so let's say that happens. So what? He says, the day after the election, working with millions of grassroots activists, I intend to do everything possible to make certain that the new president and Congress implement the Democratic platform, the most progressive agenda of any major political party in the history of the United States. Well, the fact is that these Democratic platforms have been ignored by sitting presidents repeatedly now for decades. So I'm wondering, you know, but let's just see what else the brother has to say here. That agenda includes overturning the disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, expanding Social Security, breaking up the too-big-to-fail banks, making public colleges and universities tuition-free for the middle class, and rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. Well, that's obviously, that would be good. It also includes pay equity for women. Oh, but let me just say this. In this Congress, there are people that benefit from Citizens United, that decision by the Supreme Court to make free speech equal to money. That's how many of these people got elected. Are they really going to come out against their own personal interests and oppose Citizens United? That's a question. Now, we also are talking about the pay equity for women, a new approach towards trade, aggressive action to combat climate change. Well, let's just take those one at a time. Clearly, pay equity for women, totally justified. How it will be accomplished is another matter. A new approach towards trade. We talking TPP here. What Hillary Clinton has said often is the gold standard for international trade. Is she really going to oppose it when she gets into office? This remains to be seen. Aggressive action to combat climate change. Well, this is what the Standing Rock people are doing right now. And it's pretty clear what the 1% intends to do. They have invested billions of dollars into these pipelines. Are they simply going to say, well, it's not right, let's back up? I don't know about that. Not without a very severe struggle. And, you know, we see what's happening with Standing Rock right now. Raising taxes on the wealthy and large corporations, lowering prescription drug prices, a significant movement towards universal health care, and major reforms in our criminal justice and immigration systems. If this election has taught us anything, it is that the American people are sick and tired of economic, political, and media status quo. They are tired of a rigged economy in which millions work longer hours for lower wages while 52% of all new income goes to the top 1%. They are tired of billionaires like Trump and large profitable corporations not paying a nickel in federal income taxes while the middle class pays their fair share to support governmental services. They are tired of a corrupt campaign finance system that allows billionaires like the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and others to spend hundreds of millions to elect candidates who represent the wealthy and the powerful. They are tired of corporate media that focuses on political gossip and look at elections as personality contests rather than provide for a serious discussion of the major crises facing our country. Well, I have to say, excuse me, Mr. Sanders, but is that not what Hillary Clinton is doing right now? Her entire campaign has been organized around attacking Trump personally and not explaining, getting into the fact that he is a billionaire himself, that he is a part of the problem and not the solution. All right, back to Bernie. The anger and frustration of the American people all across the political spectrum is palpable. They want a government that represents the needs of working families and not just billionaires. They want bold action to rebuild a shrinking middle class, not inside the Beltway palliatives written by corporate lobbyists. At a time of massive political discontent, when millions not only are contemptuous of the major political parties, but also are actually giving up on democracy. We need a new administration that has both vision and courage. We need vision from the top to point the way towards a new America that is more inclusive and egalitarian. which boldly addresses income and wealth inequality, poverty, and the needs of the uninsured. We need an administration that has the courage to take on the powerful special interests, corporate America, Wall Street, the insurance and drug companies, the fossil fuel industry, who stand in the way of real change and whose greed is destroying the country. I want to ask you a question. What has Bernie Sanders said about Standing Rock? Do you know? Well, Senti hasn't heard anything. I don't know if you've been looking for that particular angle, but this is the point here. It's happening right now. Okay. There is no moral excuse for the top 0.1% owning as much wealth as the bottom 90%. For one family, the Waltons, having more wealth than the bottom 42% of our population. For the number of billionaires increasing by tenfold since 2000, while we continue to have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any industrialized country on earth. There is no rational reason why we remain the only major country not to guarantee health care to all as a right to provide paid family and medical leave, or why we have more people in jail than any other country on earth, at the same time as we have these high levels of youth unemployment in minority communities. Too many Americans are living in despair and hopelessness. Too many of our brothers and sisters are turning to drugs, alcohol, and suicide to avoid the painful economic realities of their lives. Too many others are turning to rage and bigotry as they try to make sense of their declining standard of living. At a time of hateful political division, a new president can bring our people together by leading and appointing an administration that will fight for working people. We need a Secretary of Treasury who is prepared to take on the greed and illegal behavior of Wall Street, not someone who comes from Wall Street or will leave office to go to Wall Street. We need a trade representative who understands that our current trade policies have failed and that we must adopt a trade approach that represents workers and not CEOs of large corporations. We need an attorney general who is prepared to vigorously enforce antitrust laws and prosecute bankers and corporate leaders who break the law. This is a historic and pivotal moment in American history. Now is the time for our next president to rally the American people against Wall Street and corporate greed and stand up vigorously for the declining middle class. I'm afraid that Bernie may be indulging in an illusion, because I want to know what elected Democratic Congress people are with him on this, or is this him alone, or him and three or four other Congress people? You can't carry out this program that he just laid out without a majority of the Congress on your side, both Senate and Congress, and the Congress. So, I don't know. By the way, all right, let's talk about Trump's version of rigging the elections. Mr. Trump has said, and tell me if I'm wrong now, Senti, that, you know, immigrants are going to vote and that people vote repeatedly and all of this kind of nonsense.
Right.
But here's the real history of rigged U.S. elections. The harsh truth is that pursuit of power often trumps the principle of an informed electorate, choosing the nation's leaders, but that truth simply cannot be recognized. Now, this is a brief history of rigging elections in America. Okay? The United States is so committed to the notion that its electoral process is the world's, quote, gold standard, that there has been a bipartisan determination to maintain the fiction even when the evidence is overwhelming that the United States presidential election has been manipulated or stolen. The so-called wise men of this system simply insist otherwise. We have seen this behavior when there are serious questions of vote tampering, for instance, as in the election of 1960, or when a challenger apparently exploits a foreign crisis to create an advantage over the incumbent, as in the elections of 1968 and 1980, or when the citizen's judgment is overturned by judges, as in the election of 2000. Strangely, in such cases, it is not only the party that benefited from, which refuses to accept the evidence of wrongdoing, but the losing party and the establishment news media as well. Protecting the perceived integrity of the U.S. democratic process is to them paramount. Americans must continue to believe in the integrity of the system even when that integrity has been violated. The harsh truth is that pursuit of power, as I said, often trumps the principle of an informed electorate choosing the nation's leaders. But that truth simply cannot be recognized by the 1% or its media. And that's why they continue to basically cover it up and lie. Of course, historically, American democracy was far from perfect, excluding millions of people, including African-American slaves and women. The compromises needed to enact the Constitution of 1787 also led to distasteful distortions, such as counting slaves as three-fifths of a person for the purpose of representation, although obviously slaves couldn't vote. Now, can you tell us a little bit about that? What do you think about the using slaves, counting slaves as three-fifths? Do you know why they did that?
Yes, people, we need some more unity.
I think the reason they did that was it was a compromise with the South, with the Southern plantation owners. Well, what do you think that does to the integrity of the system?
Well, the whole system is rotten and fucked up and racist to begin with. And that is the foundation of the system.
Yeah, but what does it do to the thought of white citizens when they see this type of stuff? Let's think about this a minute. Well, I think it's unavoidable. People see it and then develop less and less respect for their own electoral system. They know that something's wrong, you know? Okay. That unsavory deal of the three-fifths a man enabled Thomas Jefferson to defeat John Adams in the pivotal national election of 1800. In effect, the votes of Southern slave owners, like Jefferson, counted substantially more than the votes of Northern non-slave owners. That's basically what was happening. Just a second, I'll be right with you. Okay. So even after the Civil War, when the Constitution was amended to give back, to give black people voting rights, just black men, by the way, the reality of black voting, especially in the South, was quite different from the new constitutional mandate. Whites in former Confederate states concocted subterfuges to keep blacks away from the polls to ensure continued white supremacy for almost a century. Women did not gain the right to vote until 1920, when the passage of another constitutional amendment. And it took federal legislation in 1965 to clear away legal obstacles that Southern states had created to deny the franchise, the voting franchise, to blacks. Indeed, the alleged voter fraud in the election of 1960 concentrated largely in Texas, a former Confederate state and home of John Kennedy's vice presidential running mate, Lyndon Johnson. This could be viewed as an outgrowth of the South's heritage of rigging elections in favor of Democrats, the post-Civil War party of white Southerners. However, by pushing through civil rights for blacks in the 1960s, Kennedy and Johnson earned the hatred of many white Southerners who switched their allegiance to the Republican Party via Richard Nixon's Southern strategy of coded racial messaging. Nixon also harbored resentments over what he viewed as his unjust defeat in the election of 1960. Now, we get into Nixon's so-called treason. So by 1968, the Democrats' once solid South was splintering. In other words, the Dixiecrats were going over to the Republicans. But Nixon, who was again the Republican presidential nominee, didn't want to leave his chances of winning what looked like a possible another election, you know, defeat. He didn't want to leave that to chance. Nixon feared that with the Vietnam War waging and the Democratic Party deeply divided, President Johnson could give the Democratic nominee, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, a decisive boost by reaching a last-minute peace deal with North Vietnam. The documentary and testimonial evidence is now clear that to avert a peace deal, Nixon's campaign went behind President Jackson's back to persuade South Vietnamese president to torpedo Johnson's Paris peace talks by refusing to attend. The idea was to have a representative from South Vietnam meet in Paris with a representative of North Vietnam, the country had been cut in half, and negotiate a peace deal between the two of them that would end the war. In other words, Nixon did not want the Vietnam War, to end under Johnson's administration. It's hard to believe, but it's true. That's what happened. It's documented. Though Johnson had strong evidence of what he privately called Nixon's treason from FBI wiretaps in the days before the 1968 election, he and his top advisors chose to stay silent. In a November 4, 1968 conference call, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, National Security Advisor Walt Roslow, and Defense Secretary Clark Clifford, three pillars of the establishment, expressed that consensus, with Clifford explaining the thinking, and I'm going to quote him now. "Some elements of the story are so shocking in their nature that I'm wondering whether it would be good for the country to disclose the story that and then possibly have a certain individual, that is Nixon, elected," Clifford said. "It could cast his whole administration under such doubt that I think it would be bad for the country's interest." Clifford's words expressed the recurring thinking whenever evidence emerged casting the integrity of America's electoral system in doubt, especially at the presidential level. "The American people were not to know what kind of dirty deeds could affect that process. To this day, the major U.S. news media will not directly address the issue of Nixon's treachery in 1968, despite the wealth of evidence proving this historical reality, now available from declassified records at the Johnson Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. It is a puckish recognition of this ignored history. The library's archivists call the file on Nixon's sabotage of the Vietnamese peace talks their X-file. The evidence also strongly suggested Nixon's paranoia about a missing White House file detailing his so-called treason, top secret documents that Johnson had entrusted to Rostow at the end of LBJ's presidency, led to Nixon's creation of the Plumbers, a team of burglars whose first assignment was to locate these papers. The existence of the Plumbers became public in June 1972 when they were caught breaking into the Democratic Party National Committee's headquarters at the Watergate in Washington. Although the Watergate scandal remains the archetypical case of election year dirty tricks, the major U.S. news media never acknowledged the link between Watergate and Nixon's far more egregious dirty trick 4 years earlier, sinking Johnson's Vietnam peace talks while 500,000 American soldiers were in the war zone, in part because of Nixon's sabotage and his promise to the leader of South Vietnam of a more favorable outcome. The war continued for four more bloody years before being settled along the lines that were available to Johnson in 1968. In effect, Watergate gets walled off as some anomaly that is explained by Nixon's strange personality. However, even though Nixon resigned in disgrace in 1974, he and his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, who also had a hand in the Paris peace talks caper, reappear as secondary players in the next well-documented case of obstructing a sitting president's foreign policy to get an edge in the 1980 campaign for president. Now, here's Reagan's so-called October surprise caper. This is American history of our elections. Dig this. In the case of Reagan's October surprise, President Jimmy Carter was seeking re-election and trying to negotiate release of 52 American hostages that were held in revolutionary Iran. Ronald Reagan's campaign feared that Carter might pull off a so-called October surprise by bringing home the hostages just before the election. So this historical mystery has been, did Reagan's team take action to block Carter's October surprise? The testimonial and documentary evidence that Reagan's team did engage in a secret operation to prevent Carter's October surprise is now almost as overwhelming as the proof of the 1968 affair regarding Nixon's Paris peace talk maneuver. That evidence indicates that Reagan's campaign director, William Casey, organized a clandestine effort to prevent the hostages' release before Election Day. After apparently consulting with Nixon and Kissinger and aided by former CIA Director George H.W. Bush, who was Reagan's vice presidential running mate. By early November 1980, the public's obsession with Iran's humiliation of the United States and Carter's inability to free the hostages helped turn a narrow race into Reagan's landslide. When the hostages were finally let go immediately after Reagan's inauguration on January the 20th, 1981, his supporters cited the timing to claim that the Iranians had finally relented out of fear of Reagan. Bolstered by his image as a tough guy, Reagan enacted much of his right-wing agenda, including passing massive tax cuts benefiting the wealthy, weakening unions, and creating the circumstances for the rapid erosion of the great American middle class. Behind the scenes, Reagan's administration signed off on secret arms shipments to Iran, mostly through Israel. What a variety of witnesses described as the payoff for Iran's cooperation in getting Reagan elected and then giving him the extra benefit of timing the hostage release to immediately follow his inauguration. In summer of 1981, when Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East, Nicholas Violotis, learned about the arms shipment to Iran, he checked on their origins and said later in a public broadcast program, PBS interview, and I quote, "It was clear to me after my conversations with people on high, and indeed we had agreed that the Israelis could transship to Iran some American original military equipment. This operation seemed to have started in earnest in the period probably prior to the election of 1980, as the Israelis had identified who would become the new players in the national security arena in the Reagan administration. And I understand some contacts were made at that time." Now, those early covert arms shipments to Iran evolved into a later secret set of arms deals that surfaced in the fall of 1986 as the Iran-Contra affair, with some of the profits getting recycled back to Reagan's beloved Nicaraguan Contra rebels fighting to overthrow Nicaragua's leftist government. While many facts of the Iran-Contra scandal were revealed by congressional and special prosecutor investigations in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the origins of the Reagan-Iran relationship was always kept hazy. The Republicans were determined to stop any revelations about the 1980 contacts, but the Democrats were almost as reluctant to go there. Now, see, that, I mean, now that shows you, you know, what these, the cooperation behind the scenes of these two so-called parties. A half-hearted congressional inquiry was launched in 1991 and depended heavily on then-President George H.W. Bush to collect the evidence and arrange interviews for the investigation. In other words, Bush, who was then seeking re-election, and who was a chief suspect in the secret dealings with Iran, was entrusted with proving his own guilt. By the early 1990s, the mainstream U.S. news media was also tired of the complex Iran-Contra scandal and wanted to move on. As a correspondent at Newsweek, people battled senior editors over their disinterest in getting to the bottom of this scandal before the magazine in 1990. All right, well, what basically happened is they had a PBS Frontline expose called the October Surprise, and they tried to, you know, educate the population as to what was really going on. However, by fall 1991, just as Congress was agreeing to open an investigation, They basically dropped it. That's what they did. They dropped it. And this goes on and on. I think that we have to look at this, these so-called Democrats protecting the Republicans. And eventually, I think we all know how the Supreme Court intervened in the elections in 2000. On the side of George Bush. This is a small part of the history of the corruption of U.S. elections. Senti?
I am going to briefly talk about the case of Baina El Amin. On May 5th, 2015, Jonathan Snipes, a 33-year-old gay white man, assaulted Baina El Amin, a 42-year-old gay black man at a Dallas barbecue in Chelsea. Snipes, who originally claimed El Amin had insulted him with homophobic slurs, went up to El Amin's table and attacked El Amin with his purse. Snipes later testified that he did not know if El Amin said any homophobic slurs. El Amin fought back in an act of self-defense. On September 15th, Bena was sentenced to first count of 9 years and second count of 7 years to be served concurrently, as well as 5 years post-release supervision. The system failed Bena. LGBTQ organizations, city politicians, local and national news, as well as the prosecutor's office, all used extremely anti-black hate crime language, calling Bena a brute, erasing the fact that he is a well-known queer community leader, and painting Snipes, a white gay man, as a victim when he was the one who started the fight to begin with. Bena was sentenced to 9 years for a situation that was in fact not a hate crime, but actually an act of self-defense. So there is a support page for Bena El Amin, and yes, you should support him. And if you go to the Ghost Town Prisoner Support Facebook page, then you can access the Indiegogo fundraising page for him. And he needs all kinds of support. There's information on, you know, how to write him a letter that you can also access through the Ghost Town Prisoner Support Facebook page. But at the very least, having the necessary resources to cover his legal support and move his case forward toward asking the court for an appeal is essential. So contribute what you can for Bena El Amin, and yeah, make sure that he gets what he needs while he's incarcerated.
All right, thank you. We're going to go now to this point about an investigative journalist who infiltrated armed militia hunting Mexicans and collaborating with the U.S. Border Patrol. Mother Jones senior reporter Shane Bauer now is going to be interviewed. I'm going to share this interview with you now.
Mother Jones senior reporter Shane Bauer went undercover to report on a right-wing militia movement. Using Facebook, he joined the 3% United Patriots Militia, which operates in more than a dozen states. Bauer traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border to join the militia on Operation Spring Break, a citizen vigilante mission aimed at catching undocumented immigrants. In a video accompanying the piece, Bauer explains how he landed the job using his own name and personal information, despite his years as an award-winning journalist.
When I set up my Facebook page and whenever I reached out to these guys, I used my real name. Had they Googled me, they would have seen that I was a senior reporter at Mother Jones, and they probably would not have allowed me into their organization. There's armed guards at the base, guys with AR-15s kind of patrolling it. I just kind of rolled up, had my camo on. They didn't really ask any questions. These guys were really amped up. and a lot of them were military veterans that had served in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was always worried when I was out on these things that we're going to actually run into somebody. My understanding was that if we did run into somebody, we were to call the base, and the base would call the Border Patrol. We're not supposed to shoot anybody unless somebody shoots at us. But when we're going out on these operations, guys are talking about hunting Mexicans. I mean, the stuff they're saying is like, it's not hard to imagine a situation in which they're shooting somebody.
Well, for more, we're going to Berkeley, California. Shane Bauer joins us to discuss this expose. Its headline, Undercover with a Border Militia. It was funded in part by the Puffin Foundation. Shane, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain exactly where you went and who these people were.
Thanks for having me, Amy. I initially actually joined a couple of militias in California and was training with them for several months. But my main interest was on a kind of new phenomenon of nationally organized militias. The 3% United Patriots is probably the largest of these groups, and I saw that they were having an operation on the border, so I traveled.
And explain
down
that name,
to the
3%.
Yeah, the 3% United Patriots are part of a larger movement that calls itself the 3%er movement. This movement was born after Obama's election, and they believe that the American Revolution was won by 3% of the population, and the idea is that if they can get 3% of the population behind them, then they can restore the Bill of Rights. That's kind of how they look at their work.
And do these paramilitary organizations tend to have a disproportionate number of military veterans? And if so, Shane Bauer, why do you think that is?
You know, it varies from group to group. The 3%er groups in particular do have a lot of military veterans. When I was on this border operation, I had, you know, one military Marine veteran told me that he considered this therapy. He said it reminded him a lot of Afghanistan. And I'd heard from a number of these guys that when they left the military, they missed the kind of sense of camaraderie that they found in the military. I kind of had the sense that they came back home and didn't find what they had hoped, and they had felt somewhat alienated. And in the militia, they kind of, you know, get a sense of what they had in the military. A lot of these guys also seemed to be pretty disillusioned with the military leadership and had a sense of loyalty to their former soldiers, but were generally very skeptical and frustrated with the federal government itself.
So talk about where you went. But first, I want to play this video clip that accompanies your report at Mother Jones, together with Fusion, the militia group unexpectedly meeting up with U.S. Border Patrol in the dark after a few tense moments recognizing one another. This is a Border Patrol agent who identifies himself as an intelligence officer speaking to the militia after the encounter, followed by your commentary.
You need to get a heads up next time you guys are going to calm down. Your plan on coming down into the Nogales area, since you're out in Colorado, take a trip out there and give you guys an offer.
All right.
I was really surprised to see how much the Border Patrol is cooperating with these guys.
And then when y'all get down here, I'll link up with you again.
To see, kind of be inside that world and see the ways that these guys are talking about hunting Mexicans and that kind of stuff.
That's what you gotta carry. Light.
And then to see federal law enforcement not only tolerate them, but kind of use them in a certain way.
I love having y'all out here, man. Like I said before, it impresses me that you guys come out to do my job for me for no pay at all.
Okay, well, you know, this is really, really important. And I think that here, you know, Shane Bauer also infiltrated a private prison. And came back and reported on that. But now I want to talk about.
Can you read that?
the acquittals and the Oregon standoff involving the Bundy militia at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge building outside of Burns. On Thursday, seven anti-government protesters who took over a federally owned wildlife sanctuary in Oregon last winter were acquitted of all charges. Led by Amon and Ryan Bundy, sons of rancher Cliven Bundy, who is being tried for another illegal standoff with the federal government, the group's lawyers were somehow able to persuade a jury in federal court that this was a case of government overreach, not domestic terrorism. The acquittals on all federal conspiracy and weapons charges shocked many. I had been telling my client, "You can count on being convicted," Matthew Schlender, a lawyer for one of the men on trial for the armed takeover of Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, told the Washington Post. "You don't walk into a federal court and win a case like this. It just doesn't happen. The Wild West-like armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Preserve in southeastern Oregon started as a protest against the arrests of two men who illegally started fires at the preserve, and was rooted in the rabid anti-government belief that the federal government has no right to control the lands that fall under its jurisdiction." 11 people had pleaded guilty in the standoff. One, who said he'd rather die than be arrested, got his wish. Lavoie Finicum was killed by authorities at the end of the standoff. Although the takeover was clearly planned, ringleader Amon Bundy argued it was a spontaneous action rooted in his religious beliefs. These beliefs apparently inspired him to put out the call to like-minded people nationwide to join his band of outlaws with their guns. One wonders if his beliefs and followers had been Muslim, how the argument would have gone over. The verdict is seen to have potentially frightening implications. John Horning, executive director of Wild Earth Guardians, worried it would embolden others and endanger employees of public land management agencies. "It is entirely possible there will be threats or intimidations from militants that believe such actions are justified by this verdict. It could also embolden other far-right groups calling themselves patriots, such as the Oath Keepers, who see far-ranging conspiracies like election rigging and a plot to deprive them of their Second Amendment rights. The group, which is made up of former military and law enforcement officers and others like it, are calling for members to take action on Election Day. Oath Keepers has urged its members to blend in with voters and do incognito intelligence gathering and crime spotting at polling places across the country on November 8th, the Post reported this week. The Bundy brothers remain in custody, still facing charges along with their father for the standoff at Bundy Ranch.
Now, Cynthia, you going to tell us about this situation where ICE is trying to reopen a prison that has been shut down?
Yeah, ICE has plans, like Gerald just said, to reopen the very same private prison the feds just closed. The Cibola County Correctional Center in Milan, New Mexico, is owned and operated by the Corrections Corporation of America. For 16 years, until weeks ago, it operated under contract with the Bureau of Prisons. But in early August, the Bureau of Prisons informed CCA that it would prematurely end that contract 4 years before the agreement was set to expire. The BOP's decision came just over a month after a nation investigation, produced in partnership with the Investigative Fund, revealed long-standing patterns of medical neglect in the facility, including operating for months on end without a medical doctor and failing to provide basic care and screening for infectious diseases. The Bureau of Prisons removed the last federal prisoner from Cibola on October 1st. Now a Cibola County official who says he has been briefed by CCA and members of Congress tells the nation that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, is moving forward with plans to sign an agreement with CCA to reopen the facility as an immigration detention center. ICE's detention population is expected to balloon in the next year as record numbers of Central American and Caribbean migrants who are fleeing violence and poverty try to enter the United States. It's in the works, and I think it will happen any day now, said Cibola County Manager Tony Boyd, adding that CCA informed him the contract could be signed for as long as 5 years. The company has talked to us about it to get our support. We would support that because it'll keep the jobs here. CCA and ICE declined to confirm whether contract negotiations are underway, but both U.S. News and World Report and the Wall Street Journal have also reported that Cibola is among the candidates for a new ICE detention center. And last week, CCA posted on its website a job opening for correctional officers at the now empty facility. We continue to actively market the facility to potential government partners, CCA Public Affairs Director Jonathan Burns wrote in an email. An ICE spokesperson wrote in an email that the agency can neither confirm nor discuss ongoing contract negotiations until a contract is signed between ICE and another organization. The Cibola County Correctional Center, a 1,100-bed prison, was one of 11 privately operated federal prisons used by the BOP to hold non-citizens convicted of crimes. In August, shortly after the BOP opted to terminate the Cibola contract early, saying only that the agreement was not in our best interests, the Department of Justice ordered the BOP to begin a process of shuttering all private facilities. The order followed a Justice Department Inspector General report that found the contract prisons were less secure than government-run prisons. Before the Cibola facility was closed, it was a standout example of the problems at the BOP's private prisons. The rumblings that ICE may reopen Cibola County to hold detainees rather than federal prisoners have angered rights advocates who claimed as a victory the Justice Department's decision to end its use of private prisons for people convicted of federal crimes. The DOJ's order did not apply to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is an agency of the Department of Homeland Security. More than two-thirds of ICE detainees are held in contract facilities. ISIS out of control detention practices are undoing the good that the Justice Department did just 2 months ago, says Carl Takai, an ACLU staff attorney. ICE is literally reopening contract negotiations with the same contracts and prisons that the Justice Department rejected for being unsatisfactory. As the nation reported in July before this Ebola facility was closed, it was a standout example of the problems at the BOP's private prisons. Bureau of Prisons monitors flagged an especially large number of demerits there. More significant findings of systemic failure in healthcare than any other private federal prison that was in operation at the time. The prison's medical unit was chronically understaffed, and prisoners were denied basic medical screening. The problems went uncorrected for years. At least three prisoners died in the facility in the wake of shoddy medical care. Less than 2 weeks after the DOJ ordered the BOP to begin closing all of its private prisons, Homeland Security Chief Jeh Johnson formed a commission to study whether immigration detention operations conducted by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, should move in the same direction as the Justice Department. The study is due out at the end of November, but immigration officials have not waited for the results. Last week, ICE extended a contact with CCA for 5 more years to continue operating a sprawling 2,400-bed detention center called the South Texas Family Residential Center, which is used to hold families, including children who were caught crossing the border. The overall detainee population is expected to grow by thousands over the next year as ICE pursues a long-standing policy of detaining new arrivals, including migrants seeking asylum. In recent months, an unprecedented number of Haitians displaced by poverty and repeated natural disasters have arrived on the southern border, hoping to enter the United States. And the tide of Central American families fleeing deadly violence in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala hit record levels in the past year, outstripping the headline-making rates of migration in 2014. Immediately after the DOJ's order in August, CCA and Geo Group, another private prison company, quietly began lobbying to reverse the directive after their stocks dropped by nearly half. But the recent moves by ICE may offer the company a partial recovery.
Last week, the 50th anniversary of the Black Panthers, of the founding of the Black Panthers, was celebrated in the city of Oakland. There were many, many different workshops, forums, rallies, and activities. But one of the more positive things that occurred was an encouragement to pay attention to the plight of political prisoners. I'm going to play a song now and a series of songs honoring that particular event.
It's said that every revolutionary act is an act of love, and this is an act of love. All power to the people. I said the P is for power, the A for action, the NT because now is the time to get it done. See, the H is for heart and the E for effect. The all hold it down at the end for respect. Who am I, a panther? Who am I, a panther? What I got soul. What I got love. What I got pride. What I wanna be free. Raise your hands in the air. You feel like me. Who am I, a panther? Who am I, a panther? What I got soul. What I got love. What I got pride. What I wanna be free. Raise your hands in the air if you feel like me.
Can you see the pride of the panther? expression of his race. Can you see the pride in the panther as she nurtures her young all alone? The seed must grow regardless of the fact that it's planted in stone. Can't you see the pride of the panthers as they unify as one? The flower blooms with brilliance and outshines the rays of the sun. Outshines like the sun. Shines out like the sun. Shines bright like the sun. Brings light like the sun. P is for power, the A for action, the N, T, because now is the time to get it done. See, the H is for heart and the E for effect. The all hold it down at the end for respect. Who am I, a panther? Who am I, a panther? What I got, I got soul. What I got, I got love. What I got, I got pride. What I wanna be free. Raise your hands in the air if you feel like me. Who am I, a panther? Who am I, a panther? What I got, I got soul. What I got, I got love. What I got, I got pride. What I wanna be free. Raise your hands in the air if you feel like me. This song is dedicated to all those who live and die for the struggle. Panthers, children of the Panthers, and all those who strive for free minds, free souls, free bodies, and freedom, and love. Love. Love is the engine to the revolution.
This selection originated as a poem by Tupac Shakur.
When your hero falls from grace, all fairy tales are uncovered. Myths exposed and pain magnified, the greatest pain uncovered. You taught me to be strong, but I'm confused to see you so weak. You say never to give up, and it hurts to see you welcome defeat. When your hero falls, so do the stars, and so does the perception of tomorrow. Without my hero, there's only me alone to deal with my sorrow. Your heart ceases to work, and your soul is not happy at all. What are you expected to do when your only hero falls?
As long as some suffer, the river flows forever. As long as there is pain, the river flows forever. As strong as a smile can be, the river will flow forever. And as long as you are with me, we'll ride the river together. And as long as you are with me, we'll ride the river together.
In the event of my demise, when my heart can beat no more, I hope I die for a principle or a belief that I live for. I will die before my time because I feel the shadow of death. So much I wanted to accomplish before I reach my death. I have come to grips with the possibility and wiped the last tear from my eyes. I love all who are positive in the event of my demise.
In the event of my demise, don't shed no tears. I share my wisdom with the world. They'll know I was here, know I was clear. Everything I said, I meant. An outlaw when I was born, they prepared my ditch. Said I won't live long. Statistics show I'm trying to pass 24, a realistic goal. Listen, no, you gotta stay cold inside. That's what I tell myself when I feel alone sometimes. But I can't cry, I don't care no more. I love God, so death I don't fear no more. I'm partaking in this movement to better my people. Though they see me on TV, I tell them we equal. Don't look at me as a stranger, I'm one of your own. We was raised in concrete and grew as a rose. Still I rise, but never get a chance to fly. Mama, please don't cry in the event of my demise.
In the event of my demise, can't breathe no more. Hope I die for a principle, something I live for. Dying before my time, feeling shadows of death. Trying to fulfill all my dreams before I reach my death. Came to grips with the possibility, the world's killing me. And my soldiers die young with no sympathy. I wipe the last tear from my eyes. I love all who stay strong in the event of my demise.
If I should die before I wake, let my family be straight off the money I make. Give my son what he needs other than his father. It's his self-respect, better yet his honor. When the Lord come and swallow my soul, it's so big. Cause the street took enough of my life. We all see it, it's a psycho. Make you feel psycho. Everyday struggle behind a smile, seems nobody love you. Got a piece of the streets and it's gonna die with me. May your soul forgive me, Machiavelli's within me. And the principle we stand by, stronger than power. We gon' die by the rules you can never devour. On the earth from my birth, felt nothing but pain. Only thing I ever gained was a baby to name. That's my heart, if I should go, I go on the spot. That's the event of my demise and it lurks in the dark.
And the event of my demise, can't breathe no more. Hope I die for a principle, something I live for. Dying before my time, feeling shadows of death. Trying to fulfill all my dreams before I reach my death. Came to grips with the possibility, the world's killing me. And my soldiers die young with no sympathy. I wipe the last tear from my eyes. I love all who stay strong in the event of my demise.
As I stand here, a man here, not a perfect one, but a searching one, seeking another place and time. Sound crazy, but I'm actually trying to escape my mind, trying to erase the time, hoping you didn't notice when I was at my lowest. Although I knew you was watching, I couldn't stop it. So many things I wanted to accomplish, too many dreams wasted with no promise. From out the darkness, I struggle to see the light. Rumble deep in the night, hustle with all of my might. Some won't see it that way, others is giving us praise, but all of them agreeing that I did it my way.
I was born to a storm, they won't let up. And I was raised to stay brave with my head up. And things ain't got better, we still getting wet up in this bad weather. I need more than a sweater and a leather. Yo, ain't nothing meant to last forever. So the struggling and the suffering ain't gonna last forever. And my will probably be like two lines long. It will read I'm dead, but my soul lives on. And my spirit's still living though my body is gone. In the event of my demise, I love all who stay strong. I love all who stay strong in the event of my demise. Come on.
In the event of my demise, when my heart can beat no more, I hope I die for a principle or a belief that I live for. I will die before my time because I feel the shadow of death. So much I wanted to accomplish before I reach my death. I have come to grips with the possibility and wiped the last tear from my eyes. I love all who are positive in the event of my demise.
The only way for me to come back is by Machiavelli. Ask me. All this money was stolen from me. I'm taking back what's mine.
Motherfuckers can't stop me. Even if I die, I'm gonna be a fucking problem. Do you believe in ghosts, motherfucker? Real live black ghosts. Feel me?
Some say I'm crazy, these punk ass cops can't fade me. Mama tried to raise me, but had too many babies.
Papa was a motherfucking joke. Used to find dope in his coat and nearly choke when he tell me not to smoke. Damn, don't get me started. My mama smoked so goddamn much when she was pregnant. I'm surprised I ain't retarded. At night I can't sleep, count feet as they pass through the glass of my neighbor's 5D. Staring at the wall, heard a scream. Wake up in the morning, see the blood in the hall from the murder scene. Don't cry, just ask why, and try not to die as I take you through a ghetto nigga's lullaby. On the corner where the niggas sling they crack, and the undercover's jack. Those that don't watch they back, I daydream about the dope world. Take a puff from the blunt and watch the smoke swirl. My Mossberg goes boom, comes another plug. Snatching drugs, pumping slugs in these other thugs. Don't run out of breath. Every step could be death to your blast. And be the last nigga left. Then I'll be cold. Don't cry, just ask why. And try not to die as I take you through a ghetto nigga's lullaby. Don't cry, just ask why. And try not to die as I take you through a ghetto nigga's lullaby. A 7 deuce full of niggas goes by. Thought I was tripping the second time they rolled by. Recognize the plates, the faces look familiar. But everybody swear they know the nigga that's gonna kill ya. Don't murder me, murder me. Kill a nigga in his sleep. Let me die as I rest in peace. Deep back to these niggas in the 7 deuce. A Mac 10 out the window, about to let it loose. What could I do? Run for cover and return fire. Die, motherfucking die. Hope your ass fry. Don't ask why, but I let off everything I had. An empty clip hit the ground as a nigga dash. On my ass, what's the motherfucking cops now? Barely breathing, trying to keep from getting shot down. Yeah, was the sound bullet whiz by. Still running like a nigga got 9 lives. Don't know why, but I'm running to my fucking block. Took a shot, tired of running from the niggas and the cops. Time to be a ghost.
Right. Well, on July the 24th, there was an incident occurring in East Oakland that we have reported on in this on this station, and that is a militarized law enforcement group descended on the home of Omar Shakur in East Oakland, and what they were responding to is this. There was someone fired at an Oakland Police Department sergeant by the name of Nadia Clark. When they fired on her, the Oakland Police went into a kind of a panic and set up a cordon where they basically were trying to shut off any escape for this particular person that fired the shot. Even though they had a tape of the incident, they wound up moving in on the house of Omar Shakur, with this militarized police force, snipers. They use the whole gamut with their, you know, their combat helmets, assault rifles, body armor. They started off by flashbang grenades at the front and the back of the home. After tearing down a section of the neighbor's fence, snipers were positioned on the neighbor's roofs and other locations. So all this, and then they emptied the house out. They had children in the house at the time. This was the wrong house. Nevertheless, the charges against Omar Shakur have not been dropped. And here is his appeal to the public I'm sharing with you right now. Dear community, my name is Omar Luttermilk Shakur. I was born July 23rd, 1984, to a proud mother, Fahima Keyaba. I had my first and only child in 2011, a beautiful daughter. My life has always been about working with people that have interest in bettering the world. Growing up, I played sports and martial arts with my father and a host of uncles from the community. I also loved West African drumming and dancing. My education was in private school and also Oakland Public Schools. I graduated from Bay Area School of Independent Studies in 2013, and I attended some college. My family has always loved and supported me. Overall, I am proud to be healthy and to be here for my daughter. I am not the person that shot at the Oakland Police SUV on 73rd and Wells Street, July 23rd, 2016. The police now have found the shooter, but my family and I continue to be terrorized. Together, we must stop this militarization of the police and all police terror. We are calling for community support at my next court hearing. The location is 1225 Fallon Street in Oakland. The date, November the 30th, 2016. The time, 8:30. Thank you, Omar Luttermilk Shakur. If you have the time, please come and support Omar in court at 1225 Fallon Street. I believe it's Department 7, but that can be checked. Okay?
Kinetic Justice of Free Alabama Movement launches hunger strike after being transferred to Bully Prison. Kinetic Justice is recognized as a leader within the prison strike that was initiated on September 9th. The anniversary of the Attica uprising, and he is with the Free Alabama Movement. He's an advocate that decries human torture. He has been transferred out of Holman Prison in Alabama to another prison with a reputation for being a quote-unquote bully unit for rebellious prisoners. According to Brian Sonnenstein at Shadowproof, one of the leading voices behind the national prison strike against slavery was transferred to Kilby Correctional Facility, known among Alabama prisoners to be a bully unit, where prisoners deemed disruptive are brutalized. Kinetic Justice Amun, also known as Robert Earl Council, is a member of the Free Alabama movement and was previously incarcerated at the Holman Correctional Facility. He used contraband cell phones to communicate with journalists and publish videos and audio recordings from his solitary cell at Holman. The videos showed how prisoners like him are treated. "That's bad," an anonymous prisoner reacted after he learned where Kinetic was transferred. "Kilby is our bully camp," said the prisoner, who is also a member of Free Alabama. "That's where inmates go who they deem to be problems that they have to iron out with brutality. You understand what I'm saying? When they send you to Kilby, that's where they break your arms and break your legs." Another article wrote that the transfer came only a day before justice was about to blow the lid on continued violence and brutality within Holman. According to Pastor Kenneth Glasgow, founder of the Ordinary People Society and a spokesman for the Free Alabama Movement, Council was transferred out of Holman Correctional a day before he was sent to meet with SPLC policy strategist Monique Gilman. Glasgow said, who was investigating the suicide of Robert D'Angelo Carter, "The SPLC declined to comment on the scheduled meeting, but did confirm that they were investigating Carter's death. We're looking into it," Maria Morris, SPLC managing attorney, told Jezebel. "We're also looking into the conditions in segregation units at Holman and elsewhere that allows for suicides like this to happen." In a response to the move, Kinetic has launched a hunger strike, according to an article on RT. Just 2 months after organizing a national prison labor strike, Alabama inmate Robert Earl Council, also known as Kinetic Justice Amon, is on hunger strike. Council began his hunger strike a week ago after he was transferred from Holman Correctional Facility in Alabama to Kilby Correctional a day before he was reportedly scheduled to meet with an advocate from the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC. From there, he was transferred to Limestone Corrections, a prison notorious for solitary segregation units, according to Pastor Kenneth Glasgow, a spokesman for the Free Alabama Movement. Prison officials confirm the inmate has declared a hunger strike. Bob Horton, spokesman for the Alabama Department of Corrections, told the Birmingham News on Thursday, "Medical staff has conducted an initial assessment of the inmate's condition. The inmate will be weighed daily, his food intake monitored, and proper medical care will be provided as needed." Horton told the outlet that Council stated the reason for his hunger strike was over concern for his safety. "Council is in fear of his life and will not eat any of the food they have tried to give him." And Kinetic Justice tweeted on the 9th of October that four people in 12 months have hung themselves to escape the madness. Holman segregation unit is hell on earth. Since the start of the historic September 9th hunger strike, members of FAM have remained resolute that the prison administration at Holman has intentionally escalated violence at the facility, not only against inmates through guards, but also in inmate-against-inmate violence as a means of guaranteeing tens of millions of dollars for more prison construction in the state. An article in the San Francisco paper, The Bayview, wrote, "As the culture of violence in Alabama's prison system continues to spiral out of control, yet another provocation has resulted in another day of violence at Holman Prison. Holman is experiencing major staff shortages as a result of officers joining and supporting the nonviolent work strikes being led by a Free Alabama Movement. In response to the work strikes and correctional officers quitting their jobs, the ADOC commissioners responded by dispatching CERT, team staff, and officers from other prisons to start to fill staffing positions. These CERT team officers are notorious for and have a well-documented history of violent beatings, sexual harassment, and excessive force. Just last month, CERT officers beat Cleveland Cunningham, the man who has been charged in the death of another correctional officer, leading him with an unexplained broken arm and broken leg. This after-the-fact beating was administered after it was widely reported that the news media by ADOC that Mr. Cunningham was taken into custody without incident. The same brutality was meted out in March on five men transferred from Holman after a riot had taken place. All five men were taken to W.E. Donaldson Prison, where they were taken one at a time in handcuffs, shackles, and belly chains into a guard shack and severely beaten and sexually assaulted. This matter was investigated by the commissioner's office, but not a single officer was disciplined. The attacks on Kinetic Justice is only part by a larger push by the state to bury the Free Alabama movement and the wider movement against prison slavery. We must stand behind Kinetic during his hunger strike and all of those with FAM who fight against prisons in the world of domination and white supremacy that these prisons maintain.
That makes me want to play John Coltrane's Alabama. Let's reignite the movement to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. On December the 9th, 2016, it will be 35 years since the police tried to execute Mumia Abu-Jamal, a former Black Panther and revolutionary journalist, the voice of the voiceless. Unable to kill him, the cops, courts, and politicians conspired to frame him and sentence him to death for a crime he didn't commit. Actions on this date will happen worldwide, and Oakland will be part of these protests. It took international mass mobilization to prevent his execution. Now it is taking protests and publicity to keep him alive in prison and get him effective treatment for his hepatitis C, which is still being denied by the Pennsylvania prison system. We advocate joining together now in a renewed fight for freedom for Mumia Abu-Jamal. As I said, December 9th, 2016, will be 35 years since the police tried to execute Mumia on the streets of Philadelphia. a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, Williams versus Pennsylvania, ruled that a prosecutor cannot later sit as judge over the same defendant in the post-conviction relief phase, that is, during his appeals. This is precedent-setting for Mumia, who has filed a new legal action based on the fact that Mumia's appeals of his conviction from 1998 on were denied by Justice Ronald Castile, who was the Philadelphia District Attorney, his prosecutor, during his first appeal. If successful, the Philadelphia Supreme Court rulings that upheld his conviction will be overturned. Mumia would be able to reappeal the issues of his innocence, jury bias, falsified evidence to obtain a new trial, if not outright dismissal of charges. It is unlikely that this new legal opportunity to win a court battle for Mumia's freedom will be repeated. We began the struggle for Mumia's freedom with the understanding that the fight for Mumia is one that encompasses the fight against capitalist racist injustice, from police street execution to the legal lynching of the death penalty, to frame up convictions, mass incarceration, and all horrors of the U.S. prison system. The fight for Mumia is a defense of those who stand in opposition to the policies of U.S. imperialism. It is a case of Black Lives Matter. Mumia has never succumbed to the state's attempt to silence him. He is a beacon of light and hope for other prisoners across the U.S., as well as all victims of imperialist war, racism, and the incarceration nation. We support all legal actions of Mumia's defense, but recognize that there is no justice in the capitalist courts. The Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, the LAC, focuses on mass and labor actions to free Mumia. Without such actions, the new case for Mumia's freedom will, as similar attempts have before, be consigned to the so-called Mumia exception, judicial waste bucket. We continue to work to get international labor support for Mumia's freedom and for Hep C treatment for Mumia and all prisoners. Mumia's struggles, if supported by a mass movement, can not only free him, but also help unite the struggles of prisoners and other victims of the racist, imperialist, capitalist system throughout the world. We support a renewed campaign to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. An event is planned for Philadelphia for December the 9th, 2016, initiated by the concerned family and friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal and the New York campaign to bring Mumia home. And a call is in the works. That's going to be it for our program. We hope you enjoyed it. Slave Revolt Radio.